This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As Animal Week continues, it's time for Daffy Duck, Bugs Bunny, Porky Pig, Sylvester the Cat, Tweety Bird, and the Roadrunner, the stars of the Warner Brothers cartoons. In the 1930s and 40s, audiences saw the Warner's Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies at movie theaters. Ever since the 50s, children have grown up with these cartoons on television. Steve Schneider wrote the book, That's All, Folks, The Art of Warner Brothers Animation. In 1985, he was the curator for an exhibition saluting the Warner Brothers Animation Studio at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Schneider says the Warner's cartoons were street smart and snappy, a reaction against the sometimes cute and saccharine Disney animation. I spoke with Schneider in 1989.
Well, let's look at some of the stars of the Warner Brothers cartoons and go through their characterizations and who developed them and how they changed over the years. Why don't we start with the first big star of this particular group of cartoons, and that's Porky Pig. Now, he made his debut in 1935 in a cartoon that was directed by Fritz Felling called I Haven't Got a Hat. And I want to play a short clip of this, and our listeners who know Porky Pig will see how different the character was, will hear how different the character was when he was originated. And in this, he's like a school kid, fat, self-conscious, with a stutter. And here he is in school, and by the way, the teacher is a cow.
We will now open our exercises with a recitation by our little friend, Porky Pig.
Listen, my children, and you shall hear the midnight ride of Paul Revere.
That's almost uncomfortable to listen to. It sounds like a real stutter.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, it was. Porky came along as part of a whole group of schoolroom characters. He was not intended to be the bearer of this great star awaits, you know. And the first voice that they got for it was a man by the name of Joe Dougherty. This is during the days before Mel Blanc, who's synonymous with so many of the Warner voices, had come in. In order to give the character a kind of distinctiveness, director Freeling had a character actor named Dougherty come and do the voice. Well, in fact, he had a genuine stutter. And eventually that became such a problem because they would take so much time in recording the things, he couldn't control his delivery at all. He would get stuck on words and then have to do take after take after take. Finally, they canned him, and they had Mel Blanc come in and devise a more caricatured version of what a pig's delivery would be. And in fact, I agree with you. The early versions of Porky, the voice is almost painful to listen to because you really get a sense of the poor fellow suffering there.
Yeah, and in the cartoon, he's sweating bullets.
Exactly.
So as the voice changed, how did the characterization of Porky Pig change?
Well, the Warner folks, the cartoonists, were actually a bit surprised when they finally came up with a character that caught on in any kind of massive way. So they retooled the character virtually from cartoon to cartoon. He would change his entire appearance and even his entire identity, not only changing roles from film to film, but he would be an adult, he'd be an infant, he'd be a farmer, he'd be a city slicker. It would all be changed. Finally, I think he hit his kind of classic form around 1937 when a director named Bob Clampett took over one of the units there. There were usually three or four separate units making cartoons in tandem at Warner Brothers. And Clampett had an early assignment for working with Porky and the Looney Tunes. He redesigned the character quite attractively, I believe, and also worked with Mel Blanc to come up with a voice which was humorous rather than agonizing.
How was it Porky Pig who got to do That's All, Folks? How did he get the assignment?
Well, a variation...
And I should say That's All, Folks is the verbal logo that ended all the Looney Tunes.
Right. A variation on that began as early as the audition reel that the early Warner cartoonists put together in 1929. That very first reel, which was never released to the public, ended with a character saying, "So long, folks." And that just metamorphosed over the course of years. And when Porky became popular, especially with his very, very distinctive vocal sonority, they just assumed it was a catchy and memorable way to end the films.
Well, Porky Pig was eventually eclipsed by some of his co-stars. And you point out, each new star debuted as a supporting character. And that's how Daffy Duck got his start. He got his start as a supporting character in a Porky Pig cartoon. So why don't we look at Daffy Duck next? And this is from a 1946 cartoon called Daffy Doodles. And in this cartoon, Daffy Duck has taken on the fiendish mission of drawing mustaches on every billboard in town.
progression in life, we get into different ruts. Some are the cogs on the wheels. Others are just plain nuts. I'm just wild about Harry, and Harry's wild about me. Science is some folks' calling. Others pilot a ship. My mission in life stated simply is a mustache on every lip.
I have to tell you, Daffy Duck was always one of my favorite characters. He was such the con artist and such the always bluffing his way through everything.
Exactly. I mean, he began really as the flightiest and the kind of most footloose of them all, but gradually became more inwardly directed. He was a creature really responding to a kind of set of neuroses, which was unused to being present in animated cartoons. I mean, he became self-serving and greedy and egotistical at the same time as he would always set himself up for failure. And again, as in, I think, the Roadrunner cartoons, which came later, it's a relationship between desire and failure that motivates so many of the Warner comic underdogs, like the Coyote and also Daffy Duck. Daffy, I think, had about the most protean existence of all the characters there. For some reason, most of the directors, certainly all of the stronger directors, Tex Avery, Bob Clampett, Chuck Jones, a couple of the others, found in Daffy, I think, perhaps their most receptive vehicle. They would refashion him virtually from picture to picture, and he became perhaps the strongest statement of their individual temperaments as filmmakers.
Do you know how Mel Blanc developed the sputtering voice for him?
Well, one story has it that it was actually a takeoff of boss Leon Schlesinger's speech. Schlesinger had a lisp, and they were trying to come up with some kind of way to add a little bit of a zing to this otherwise, you know, anonymous duck at the point. And someone suggested that they impersonate Schlesinger's voice. And they did that very early on, and Daffy's duck, like Daffy's voice, like many of the others, was sped. So the lisp there, the sputter actually was engendered by Schlesinger's lisp. And then, according to legend, when Schlesinger first heard the Daffy voice, he fell on the floor loving it and not knowing the fact it was a gentle piece of ridicule against Mr. Big there.
My guest is Steve Schneider, author of A History of Warner Brothers Cartoons. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1989 interview with Steve Schneider, author of That's All, Folks, A History of Warner Brothers Cartoons.
Now, Daffy Duck in many cartoons was hunted by Elmer Fudd. That was also the fate of Bugs Bunny. Bugs Bunny was also hunted by Elmer Fudd. Elmer Fudd was not very bright, always getting conned by Bugs and Daffy. Let's hear a clip of Elmer Fudd's voice. And this is from a 1952 cartoon called Rabbit Seasoning.
It's wabbit season. Oh, boy, wabbit twax. Oh, White Wabbit, I know you're there. If you're not out in 10 seconds, I'll blast you out. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay, Wabbit, now I got you.
What's up, Doc?
I'm hunting wabbits. It's wabbit season.
The voice of Elmer Fudd is one of the few voices that wasn't done by Mel Blanc.
Yeah, in fact, it's the only really long-ranging voice that Mel didn't handle, outside of some of the female ones. It was done by a radio actor named Arthur Q. Bryan, who was a pudgy dumpling of a man, who was freelancing in radio in various and sundry capacities, and he had this voice, and this seemed to be the definitive milksop, you know, the all-purpose schmo that someone like Bugs Bunny could play off of, and so they seized upon it immediately.
I've always thought of Elmer Fudd as being the square in the cartoons. Also, the stupid authority figure. The authority figure who was always conned by the other characters.
Yeah, exactly. He's a kind of the all-purpose dimwit aggressor. You know, some people have, over the years, kind of raised some hackles about the allegedly violent content of these cartoons. And let's face it, Fudd might be an example of this because he's always coming after someone with a rifle, or at least in his most prototypical occasions. And if you think about it, in every single one of Warner cartoons, the aggressor is always the one who loses. I mean, it has a kind of anti-violent attitude in a strange sense. If you get too heavy, firstly, you're made to look ridiculous because you're such a sap, in the case of Fudd, or so flustery and so blustery like Yosemite Sam. The morale here is that antagonism never pays off in these films. You always get your just desserts from someone who is sharper or or wittier or more resourceful than you are.
Let's move on to the Warner Brothers superstar, and that's Bugs Bunny. They're a great song and dance man. And to introduce the voice of Bugs Bunny, let's go to one of the great parodies of the Warner Brothers cartoons. This is a parody of Wagner's Ring Cycle, and this is called What's Opera, Doc? And the plot, of course, is Elmer Fudd hunting Bugs Bunny, but it's all done in opera.
Oh, mighty warrior of great fighting stock, might I inquire to ask him, what's up, Doc?
I'm going to kill the wabbit.
Oh, mighty hunter, twill be quite a task. How will you do it, might I inquire to ask?
I will do it with my spear and magic helmet.
Your spear and magic helmet?
Spear and magic helmet.
Magic helmet.
Magic helmet.
Magic helmet.
Bugs Bunny was really the great vaudevillian, the great opera star, the great song and dance man of the Warner Brothers cartoons. How did he get that kind of entertainment, Mr. Entertainment personality?
Well, I just think that he was a creature of infinite flexibility and essentially...
He's talented.
Yeah, I mean, before long, he was all bunnies to all people. Before long, they just had him do everything, and there was always a new context for him. I just think that his braggadocio or his shamelessness or just, you know, the brightness of his smile motivated the cartoonist to put him in these kinds of contexts.
It was funny, you know, I was watching a lot of the cartoons last night, and there were so many cartoons, including the one we just heard an excerpt of in which Bugs Bunny disguises himself by appearing in drag and trying to do the sexual tease on whichever hunter is hunting him.
Yeah, almost from his very first film, that's a bit of the bunny shtick. Again, it's because, well, as I mentioned, it's almost like he has no weight of a self. He can do virtually anything. He's quicker than Groucho and tougher than Cagney at the same time. And I think going in drag was, you know, the cartoons were always sort of ghettoized or never really considered mainstream artworks in their own way. And this way, at the very, very margins of the movie world, these guys were able to get away with some subversive images or ideas that were just neglected. The only way that it was possible is that these things were so ignored for so long that they carved out a little niche of freedom for themselves.
How did What's Up, Doc become his motto?
A couple of theories on this. I think the most plausible one is it was just a phrase from Tex Avery's youth when he was growing up in Texas. They gave it to the character accidentally or randomly, and the reaction was so strong from that very first moment that they stuck with it. Again, Avery has a quote, and he said, you know, audience were expecting the character to scream or do anything outside of come up with an understated remark, and then they said, boy, we'll do that every chance we got, and they did.
Steve Schneider recorded in 1989 after the publication of his book, That's All, Folks. Animator Chuck Jones made many of the classic Warner Brothers cartoons featuring Daffy Duck, Bugs Bunny, Elmer Fudd, and Porky Pig. He created the characters Pepe Le Pew, the Roadrunner, and Wile E. Coyote. Jones worked at Warner Brothers from 1933 until the studio closed down its cartoon division in 1962. Then Jones formed his own production company and created primetime TV specials. He was given an honorary Academy Award in 1996. Jones is now in his mid-80s and is still working. I spoke with Chuck Jones in 1989. One of his most famous cartoons, Duck Amuck, is a cartoon about animation. Daffy Duck finds himself at the mercy of a fickle cartoonist. Daffy opens the cartoon dressed as a brave musketeer, but the cartoonist keeps changing the scenery on him to the most inappropriate settings, a farm, the Arctic, Hawaii. The cartoonist eventually erases not only the background, but Daffy himself.
Would it be too much to ask if we could make up our minds?
Dashing through the snow, through the fields we go, laughing all the way.
Farewell to thee, farewell to thee. The wind will carry back our sad refrain. One last embrace before we say, Buster, it may come as a complete surprise to you to find that this is an animated cartoon, and that in animated cartoons they have scenery, and in all the years I... All right, wise guy, where am I?
You changed a lot of the characters who you worked with over the years.
Uh-huh.
And can you describe when you first started directing Daffy Duck, who was always my favorite? When you started directing Daffy Duck, what was he like? And then maybe you could tell us a little bit of the character changes that you brought to the Daffy.
It's a little difficult to isolate them exactly as to what I contributed, but I all the characters I felt were part of me, particularly Daffy and the Coyote, because they made the kind of mistakes that most of us make, only multiplied a bit. But Daffy was an interesting character, I think, because he would rush in and fear to tread at the same time. And he also could be fawning and overbearing at the same time. And I think that happens with very many of us when we, sometimes in the reverse, when we go in to talk to the boss and ask for a raise, we're overbearing. When we get inside, we're fawning. But Daffy is both at the same time. At the beginning, he was just crazy, as was Bugs. Even in the first great, Wild Hare that Tex Avery directed, the character was really kind of mad, more like Harpo Marx, perhaps. And I was never comfortable with a character unless I could understand him, and I can't understand crazy people. So I always try to sort of pasteurize my characters to find out who they are. Who is the whole point about character animation is not what. It isn't what a character looks like or indeed how it's drawn.
You sound like a method animator.
Well, I guess so. I don't think that I could do it unless I cared about the characters.
In your cartoon, Duck Amuck, why did you choose Daffy Duck as the character that was going to be at the whim of the cartoonist?
Well, I tried it later with Bugs Bunny and didn't work. Fortunately, I did Duck Amuck first, then I did one called Rabbit Rampage, and he also had the same problem, and the person in this case turned out to be Elmer Fudd that was moving him around, but it didn't work because that's not the kind of a person that Bugs is. Bugs is a comic hero, you see, as compared with a comic wimp, which would go back to all the great comedians, starting with Chaplin and Buster Keaton and all the rest of them. They were they're all kind of semi-losers, aren't they? They're more like us. But I always liked Daffy because he would continue beyond where I would stop simply because I'd be afraid of what the community would think of me. Daffy continues, so... But when I was working with him, all I had to do was reach down inside of me and bring the Daffy up to the surface and spread it out and take a look at it and see what would I do if I had Daffy Duck's courage.
Mm-hmm. All the great characters of the Warner Brothers cartoons are all animals. They're animals with the traits of people, but they're not people. They're ducks and rabbits and skunks. What are some of the advantages of using animals instead of people for the cartoons?
Well, we had ample precedents to go on. I mean, going back to Aesop's Fables and Kipling and even Mark Twain did several things about animals, and of course Beatrix Potter and so many others. But the main thing is that it's easier to humanize animals than it is to humanize humans. And it's as you know from seeing Snow White and the Poor Princes and all the Disney films, it's very difficult to animate human beings. And when we did animate them, they didn't look very much like human beings. I mean, Elmer Fudd doesn't look any more like a human being than Bugs Bunny looks like a rabbit. Bugs is obviously not a rabbit. Rabbits look more like, the average rabbit looks very much more like a pillow than anything else. However, I think that taking a rabbit and making him as heroic as Bugs Bunny is a lot more easy than it is to take a human being and make him like Bugs, with Bugs' characteristics.
You always believe that in a cartoon world that you have to create certain rules of the universe, and the characters always have to live within those rules. Give us an example through, say, the Roadrunner, Wile E. Coyote cartoons, because you created those characters.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the universe that you created them in.
Well, there are several things that happen in all comedy. The more you channelize, the more you narrow your character down, the better it gets. For some reason, take Charlie Chaplin, when he once got that little costume, look how much he was restricted in what he could do. He could only be the little tramp, but he could be the little tramp and he also limited the little tramp in pretty much into living in a city. Well, we felt that when we got the Roadrunner and Coyote going, it was evident that they both lived in the southwestern American desert. And so you immediately say to yourself, that's where they live, that's where they got to live. And the fact that the roadrunner is a roadrunner means that he should stay on the road. And there were a number of other rules about that, that the roadrunner can never harm the coyote. The coyote can only harm himself by buying those unfortunate things he gets from the Acme Corporation. So on. So that's what we... And the more rules you apply, you never hear any other sound except the beep-beep. And I found that with going back then to Bugs Bunny. Bugs Bunny is such a powerful character, and he's a comic hero rather than a loser. He's such a powerful character that he could become a terrible bully. So we always started Bugs. In every picture, we started him in a natural rabbit environment, minding his own business, a quiet living rabbit, something like Rex Harrison, perhaps, before he got involved with My Fair Lady, ladies. And then someone comes along and tries to deprive him of his foot or his life or his, you know, or sending him off on a rocket or something. And then he has to fight back, you see. And when once engaged in the war, then he's happily engaged. But without that, he would just be a bully. And there were some characters like Heckle and Jekyll and even Woody Woodpecker at some time seemed to go out and just heckle people for no particular reason. Bugs never did that. And this is vital and necessary if you wanted the character to be believable and for people to care about him.
My guest is animator Chuck Jones. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1989 interview with animator Chuck Jones, who made many of the classic Looney Tunes cartoons.
One of the characters you created was Pepe Le Pew, this skunk who thinks he's very debonair and quite irresistible, but he's really quite repulsive. He has no idea. And he has this great fractured French that he speaks. As a matter of fact, let me just play a little excerpt of Pepe Le Pew, and this is from a cartoon that you won an Academy Award for, Sentimental Reasons.
Quel est? Ah, the petite femme skunk. The rendezvous, no? Ah, my darling, how beautiful you are. How lonesome it has been that I have without you. The sweet nothings. The sweet somethings. The tender enrapturements. But I forget. But of course, the rendezvous.
Why did Pepe Le Pew have to be a French skunk?
Because it's funnier that way. Uh-huh. A Bulgarian skunk probably wouldn't have been as interesting, or any Egyptian skunk. So, I don't know, French, that the idea that French believe that they are the most desirable of all men, I don't know, that's still prevalent, but at that time we thought of them that way. But I was a complete wimp in high school, and I was 6'1", weighed 132 pounds, so girls looked right through me and could see other men. So I suppose it was natural for me to find to compensate for that by making a character who, regardless of what he was, believed he was an absolute, the most desirable of all people.
Did Maurice Chevalier ever say anything about this character?
I don't really know whether he did or not. I imitated him a couple of times. We had him sing a couple of songs the way Chevalier would have sung them.
Uh-huh.
We never ever imitated any character completely.
Right.
But sometimes we would infuse a little bit of a lot of characters, like George Sanders eating a chicken wing is very much like Bugs Bunny eating a carrot.
Now, I grew up on the Warner Brothers cartoons, and the older I'd get, the more jokes I'd get. But I never realized I was missing anything when I was young, you know, because I always liked them. And now as an adult, I see things that I didn't see when I thought I was getting all the jokes when I was an older kid. Did anyone at Warner Brothers ever give you an argument that certain things there would go over the head of the heads of the audience?
Yeah. Yes, they did. But we didn't pay attention to them. We always had going battles on with our producers. So they would issue edicts like, don't make any pictures about bullfights. Bullfights aren't funny. Well, that immediately would say, well, gee, obviously the guy has always been wrong. So we made a picture about a bullfight, and it turned out fine. No, we had very little problem. Fortunately, our producers were not very bright.
Did you ever think of yourself as doing a pop kind of surrealism?
I did some, they tell me, but I never did anything. You know, by sitting down and saying, I'm doing this for a reason.
Right.
What I was trying to do was to develop the characters that I understood and to have fun doing it. And that was the whole secret of Warner Brothers cartoons, is a bunch of people happened to come together from varied walks of life, all of whom were enormously interested in making films that were fun to do.
Animator Chuck Jones, recorded in 1989.